Okay, the problem I'm going to be discussing is, given a set of genomes, and I'll formalize that in a minute, or illustrate it in a minute, which are basically gene orders, and given a phylogenetic tree, which represents the relationship between the genomes, to find the ancestral genome. So this is a phylogenetic tree with three genomes, A, B, and C, and they're meant to have an ancestor here and an ancestor here. Now, what do the genomes look like? Well, they're just strings of symbols, and you can the important thing to note is that you can have several copies of the same symbol in a genome. Like this, the symbols represent genes, so there are two copies of gene 2 here and three copies here and two copies here. And when we talk about a copy of a gene, it can either be an identical gene, or it can be slightly different but still coding for the same protein, or it could be coding for a slightly altered protein with the same function, or it'd be coding for a considerably altered protein with a related function. For our point of view, from our point of view, it doesn't matter. We hope that the biologist will have done a neat job of categorizing the genes into gene families, which are as specific or as generic as he or she needs for the purposes of the project, whatever project they're working on. So, but from our point of view, we count them. We just use the same symbol, but I'm going to introduce some additional structure in a minute. First, I want to point out that some of these have a minus sign in front of them, and the other ones we can implicitly assume have a plus sign. And what this basically refers to is the DNA strand on which the gene is found. We can imagine that the of the two paired strands, the positive ones are read from the 5' end to the 3' end this way, and the ones on the negatives, the ones that are marked with a minus sign, are read in the other direction. They're on the opposite strand, and they're read in this direction. Okay, when you're reading past the gene, say the gene is on it's marked with a minus sign. When you're reading the complementary strand, it nothing happens. It's not coded. Okay, it's only transcribed when it's read in the right sense. So now I said that there's these the innovations that I'll hope to discuss today are basically caused by, are basically provoked by the fact that we have gene families, okay? That this is the gene family for gene 2. This is the gene family for gene 1. Notice there's no ones in this genome. And 3 has several copies. And in solving this problem, we need some supplementary data. So for each gene family, for example, gene family 2, we are given a gene tree representing the evolutionary history of all the copies of that gene. Basically, we're given the gene tree. What it means is that the biologist will take the sequence, the nucleotide sequence, or the amino acid sequence, throw it into a phylogeny program, which you might have heard something about this week. There are many different approaches to making a phylogeny, and whatever it is, whatever the biologist's favorite program is or technique is, it will give a tree that looks like this. And what this tree means is that if this is the first copy of gene 2, this refers to the first copy of gene 2 in this genome, this refers to the second copy, this refers to the third copy in genome 3, this is the first copy in genome 3, and this is the third copy, and it gives you this sort of tree, which isn't a phylogenetic tree, because we're only talking about three species, but it's we call it a gene tree because it has all the copies of the that particular gene in all the genomes that you have. So notice that ABC looks like this tree, and you can imagine that that there was some gene here that is picked up, that is some gene at this time here, one member of the family that was picked up in position 1, let's say 3 and 1 here, and that's but what happened here is likely that the gene duplicated once or several times, and this is reflected in the other members of gene family too. The important thing is that we'll have a tree like this given to us for gene family 2, we'll have another one given to us for gene family 3, another one given to us for gene family 1, and so on. So there'll be trees, and they don't necessarily look, they're arbitrary, they can be any trees. I should say that this problem, without where you're not allowed to have gene families, you can only have one copy of each gene in each genome, and each genome has to have exactly the same number of genes, so that every genome is basically a permutation of every other genome, except for the plus or minus sign, or with the additional liberty of having a plus or minus sign. So the case where every genome is a permutation of the symbols from 1 to n with a plus or minus sign in front of each symbol, that problem has been studied, and there are programs to do it. The difficulty, which becomes it's a very important difficulty and opens up a whole new, several whole new tracks, is the fact that you can have several copies of each gene, and you don't have to have, you can also have zero copy of some genes in a genome. Okay, now what are the methods one other thing. When I say to reconstruct the genomes at these ancestral nodes, I mean I'm going to have to reconstruct something like 1, 2, minus 2, 3, 4, 5, or something like that at this position, and something like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 1, 2, 3, minus 4, 5 at this position. I have to reconstruct the genomes at these two positions. Of course, I haven't said yet what criteria, how do I know I've done the right thing or done a reasonable thing? And in fact, most of my talk is just going to be to reformulate this problem and to pose it well, to make it, this is a very loosely posed problem. I want to end up with a well-posed problem with some hints of solution of how to solve it.
Right, they don't give the order.
But you're right, the gene trees tell you a lot about, basically what they tell you about is, what they tell you is exactly how many copies of each gene were at each of the ancestral nodes, and the all the ancestral relationships. But these, but they're scrambled, okay? So basically we have no idea about the order. And what we want is that the genome has this fixed order. That's why we're doing it.
Yeah, that's fine. Just curious, I mean, why do you want the order in addition to not what the ancestors
say? We want the order because, you know, why people want gene orders, you could ask the people who do the Human Genome Project why they bother assembling their you know, this you know, gene order is of interest, point of view of evolution, and maybe point of view of function, which genes are next to each other, and so on. So the gene order is an important, it's the structure of the chromosome, basically. Right. Right. Everybody
so
will do it. You know, I have no answer for that. I just know that when you go to a website like the COGS website at NIH, where they'll give clusters or something of orthologous genes, or various, as you know, various people will make gene families in different ways, and there's many, many different ways, and I have no idea how to do it. I'm just taking whatever the definition of the gene family is given by the biologist.
Isn't this critical?
Critical, yes, it's critical. Well, that's not strictly right. And as a first order approximation, if you think if the kinases indeed were generated by some very long history of duplications and losses, and then there's going to be some sort of gene tree. And as a first approximation, the different methods of defining the families are just going to sort of cut the tree off at different levels. So some method that groups everything that's got a 30% match in amino acids or 25% match in amino acids is going to lump them all together. Something that requires 80% or 90% match is going to throw away the whole top of the root of the tree and all the early nodes and just keep a bunch of small families. So as a first approximation, of course, there's all sorts of subtleties and ways that breaks down, but
very useful, and it doesn't include the entire genome. Actually, there are hundreds of superfamilies done this way, because proteins on the whole are very different. And if you take typically a pair of proteins out of the genome, they will show no resemblance, and they will be less than 15% identity at the protein level. So
I mean, in response to the question, it's a question of the resolution of the method, perhaps, but as a first approximation, how severe you are about requiring genes to be, how similar they have to be in the family, shouldn't really bias, if you change your definition slightly, you shouldn't really change the resulting tree. It depends on how many gene families you have and how much of the evolutionary signal is conserved and various things. But, you know, that is a very hairy problem, and I have, you know, I know very little about it. I mean, I've seen lots of people do it, you know, define families, but I don't have any strong feelings about it.
Doesn't it matter a lot, though, because if you take what is in fact one monophyletic group of genes in the genome, they have a single common ancestor, if you use it or retrieve it, if you mistakenly fall into two groups, might you not reconstruct two ancestor genes of the fact there was only one?
Yes. Yes, you're right. I think what will happen in that case, ideally, from this method, is that if you don't put in the information that these genes are related, what will happen, hopefully, from this method, as maybe you can, you'll have some intuitions afterwards, is that those genes will end up being clumped together in the ancestral genome, and they'll still be there because the genome doesn't, the method doesn't know that they're the same family. But you're absolutely right about that. You'll get, you know, you conserve the gene family as you go up the tree. So if there are too many gene families, you have too many genes. Okay. So first I'm going to talk about the different components of the methodology or the approach that I'll be using, and these really come from, they're all methods in computational biology which have been investigated independently. They really have nothing to do with each other in for a large part. There's at least three separate problem areas that have been investigated for different reasons, and as you'll see, they sort of fit together in a surprisingly neat way to allow us to formulate this problem correctly. One is definitions of genomic distances, which involve genome rearrangements, which involve gene order. Okay, based on just the gene order, how do you what's a good way of expressing the difference between genomes? And this, there have been many definitions, and they've been some of them have been highly motivated biologically. For example, we know that gene orders change by a process of inverting a segment of the chromosome, an arbitrarily long segment of the chromosome. And if you just count the number of inversions that are necessary to go from one genome to another, that gives you a measure of their distance. It's even a metric. And there are other methods that are less motivated. If you just, there's all sorts of statistical methods that involve the distance between pairs of genes and how these are correlated, for example. Just take the for every pair of genes, take the number of positions that separated. They're separated and correlate those in the two genomes, and that gives you a measure of similarity. But that's not motivated biologically. And there's all sorts of things, and there's a whole literature. But basically, what's missing is that these definitions require one genome to basically be a permutation of the other. Now, many of these methods, there's various patches you can add on and say, well, you know, let's take, take the average if you leave out this gene from this position or when you leave it out from this position. There's various patches, but neatly, the definitions in their neatest and most intuitive form, require that each genome be a permutation of the other. And we don't have that in our problem because we have gene families and we have missing genes from genomes. Okay. Now, if you take one of these distances, even where each genome is a permutation of the other, and you do the archetypical or the prototypical phylogenetic problem, which is take three genomes and find the fourth one, which we call the median, such that the sum of the three distances is minimal, that problem has been looked at a great deal, and turns out that it's hard, and it's NP hard. And in all of these distances, all of the interesting distances. So this, but there are algorithms which work for moderately long genomes, okay, even though it's hard. So there's a literature in this, and there's some software that you can download off the web from a couple of sites. Third, there is a general way that we looked at, which has some intuitive basis for extending these distances to allow for multi-gene families. So there's a very small literature. There's maybe three papers on this. And we call them exemplar distance, and I'll come back to that. And finally, there's something known as gene tree, species tree reconciliation. So if you're given a species tree, like like this, and a gene tree like this, there's a whole literature on what you, in projecting this type of thing onto this type of thing, and what type of interpretations you can make. And that's a whole separate literature. And this only works for one gene family at a time. See, this is the tree for gene family 2, and it'd be completely, and whatever you do to this to get the history of this gene, where it duplicated, where it was lost, and so on, it only pertains to one gene. There's no method that takes into account a bunch of different genes at the same time. Okay, let's look at a couple of these genomic distances. Here, genome X, we model this inversion process involving the chromosomal fragment 3, 4, and 5. And that gives us 1, 2, minus 5, minus 4, minus 3, and 6. Why the minus? Because if you imagine a stretch of DNA that reads from left to right, and you break, have double-stranded breaks at both ends of the stretch, turn the fragment around and reattach it, now, just chemically, because of the direction of the way that the bonds are formed, the gene has now on the other strand and is read from right to left. You've inverted the order of the genes, and you've also changed the reading order. So it gets a minus sign. All those genes get a minus sign, and they're in the other order, in a reverse order. And then imagine these things accumulate. This is what makes things interesting. Perhaps this fragment, 2 and minus 5, inverts next. So the minus 5 gets put back in the original strand, and now the 2 is sent to the other strand, and the order has changed, 5 minus 2. The rest stays the same. So genome Z now has this order after 2 inversions. And you can't get from here to here in less than 2 inversions if you want to try. And we can call this the inversion distance between X and Z. And the inversion distance is 2 in this case. Inversion, and it's easy to see that it's that we don't say anything about there. It's arbitrary for the time being. Okay.
Biologically,
it isn't known, and there's lots of data. There's not a lot of data. There's some people who think now that there might be a lot of small inversions. Other people think that it's completely random. If you look at these things clinical in a population or in a species are mostly they happen a lot, but they're mostly pathological, and you see where they happen. They happen mostly, the breakpoints mostly at the telomere or something, but there's no good systematic results on this. And I'm going to talk a little bit about this tomorrow, actually. Yeah.
What about other processes besides conversions, translocations?
Okay. Well, there's clearly the other major process like this is translocation, and you can define a translocation distance in the same way. You can define a combined inversion and translocation distance. You can define a weighted okay. You can define, there's something called the transposition, which is of dubious biological significance, where you take a little fragment of the genome or a big fragment and you move it somewhere else and insert it somewhere else. It's not known, for convenience, we sometimes treat that formally as a process, or whether it actually happens or it's a result of two or three other processes. But there is a whole literature on this, which I'll come back to in this. A translocation is in a multi-chromosomal genome, where there's more than one chromosome. You break off one end of one chromosome and one end of the other chromosome at an arbitrary place along a branch, along an arm of the chromosome, and you repair them in the wrong order. So that's a translocation. And formally speaking, actually, it has a lot. It's very similar to an inversion. It's actually, in a certain sense, it can be considered as an inversion. I'm sorry, I didn't hear that last.
Was it common for it to go from a situation where you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 and then -5, -4, -3 to add on?
Oh, there's duplication is a very common process, and that's a whole segment of the chromosome or parts of the chromosome, but this has not. That's one of my points, that this has not been treated in the genomic distance literature yet, okay? I'm coming back to that later on. That's one of my worries in this paper. Another distance which is less well motivated biologically is just take the adjacencies in one genome and see how many of them are disrupted in the other. So turns out that all the adjacencies in this genome except one are disrupted here. One is not adjacent to two, two is not adjacent to three. Three is adjacent to four in the strict sense that three is red and then four is red immediately after. Here three is red, then four is red, and here, because of the minus sign, they're red in this order, three, then four. So this adjacency is conserved. 4, 5 adjacency is no longer in here. 5, 6 isn't in there. So if of the five adjacencies, only one is conserved. And so that we say that the other adjacencies we call breakpoints. And the number of breakpoints here is four. And the number of, this is also a metric, okay? But this, it has a rough biological motivation in the sense that each inversion here or each translocation breaks up two adjacencies in general. So there's a rough connection between the breakpoints and the inversion distance, but it's not actually, this is a lower, this distance divided by 2 is a lower bound of this distance. But there's no other relationship. Now, as I said, there's a literature on this. Perhaps the jewel of this theory of genomic distances is a series of papers by Hannon, Halley, and Pevsner, where they showed that this inversion distance can be calculated in polynomial time, and as a matter of fact, it can, I believe, can be calculated in linear time, or close to linear time. So this is, it can be, but the algorithm is horrific, and the algorithm has been improved by various people: Hannon, Halley himself, Berman, Kaplan, Shamir, and Tarjan, Bader and Moret, Bergeron. All these are all people that have worked on this algorithm, which is a horrendously complicated algorithm, but it's not complex in the computer science term. It's a polynomial algorithm, a very neat algorithm, and many people had tried to find this in the early 90s without any luck, and it wasn't even known if it was polynomial or hard NP-hard problem. And so this discovery of Hannon-Halley and Pevsner was quite an event. And they proceeded to show that translocation distance was also can be handled by the same type of mathematics. There was also a polynomial algorithm, and that translocation plus inversion distance was also a polynomial time problem. So, and of course, the breakpoint distance is a snap. You can just look. You can do it by eye, and you can do it in linear time if you're with the input. And I'm sure with the proper data structure, if you stored the genomes in the proper way, you could do it a lot more quickly as well. So, there's a related problem that actually was discussed a number of years earlier. The pancake flipping problem. If you have a pile of pancakes that come out of the kitchen in an order which is not nicely pyramidal, for example, just a small pancake, then a big one, and three small ones, how do you put them in a nice order by just taking a spatula and flipping over the top few? And you can do this as many times as you want. So here, it suffices to flip over the top three, and then you get it perfectly. So, phrasing it in terms of pancakes is frivolous. It has to do about methods of sorting numbers quickly using the simple operation of inverting a prefix. So it's not a problem which is motivated by culinary considerations. And so this had been studied a number of years earlier, and here's the reference. But they couldn't solve it, and I don't know what happened to this guy, but he couldn't hack it. And there's a phase. There's a you mean in some terms of some sort of the answer is probably what log n, right, or something, according to the right criteria. I fooled around with that once a long time ago, and I you can phrase it in such a way that it's very similar to a card shuffling problem and so on. Okay, so I've mentioned a bit about these genomic distances, and the problem with them for our purposes is the multi-gene families and the missing genes in genomes. Okay, so we can't use them directly. Now let's pause a while and put that aside for a while and go to this next problem, the phylogeny problem, which is basically, given these three genomes, find this median such that the sum of the distances is minimal. So, as I said, this problem is hard for reversal distance, for breakpoint distance, whatever your type of genomic distance you use within this class of measures. And this has been shown, there's a simple proof by David Bryant. But the interesting thing is that for breakpoint distance, for the breakpoint distance and number of adjacencies, there's a neat trick that was discovered by Blanchette, because you have to arrange, for each genome, you have to arrange the genes in order along the genome, in the ancestral genome, in this M. And how do you know whether two genes should be together in that ancestral genome? Well, clearly, if they were together in each of A, B, and C, it makes sense to put them together in M, because you wouldn't, otherwise you'd be introducing breakpoints. And even if they're together in two of the genomes, you'd want to put them together probably. And so Blanchette simply introduced the idea that the distance between two genes is 3 minus the number of times the genes are adjacent in these three genomes. So it's either 0, 1, 2, or 3. And then you have to, given those distances on the sort of clique of all genes, you have to find a circuit of minimal length, which is a traveling salesman problem, basically. There's some business about joining them together at the end, but so what Blanchette did was convert the median problem for genomes into a traveling salesman problem on the genes. Now, we know that the traveling salesman problem is also a hard problem with respect to the same parameter, the length of the number of genes in the genome, but we also know that you can make money from the traveling salesman problem if you have a good algorithm. So there are lots of good algorithms out there that work for relatively long genomes. So based on that, we now have fairly good software for solving the median problem. Of course, we solve it for the case where every genome is a permutation of every other genome. And it's much harder when some genomes are missing certain genes. And however, in this case, we still have good heuristics, which I can mention. And I'm going to come back to that. And the hardest is where we also have multi-gene families. So there's software for this, and there's good software for this. There's functional software for this, but it's approximate. And this is what we're talking about today, where we're actually working with multi-gene families, where not only the genomes have different gene content, but each gene can be in several copies or in each genome. Yeah.
But if you don't know which of the three belongs to which of the three in another genome.
In the case you're talking about, if you had three copies of the gene in all the genomes and you had all the orthologies, You wouldn't consider, you'd make separate families for each one. You wouldn't worry about them, okay?
Well, they can be very near to each other, but as long as the species difference is smaller than that.
Right, exactly.
So I'm correct. So the motivation of this is that it's an interesting formal problem, or is it that a star phylogeny is a relatively good approximation to a phylogenetic tree?
No. That reminds me, I should have said that we've been doing this medium problem with three, but there's no reason this whole business about the traveling salesman works very well if you have four or five or six star phylogeny. Now, the role of the star phylogeny will come back to the medium, will come back to later. We use that as sort of the heart, the inner loop of the phylogeny optimization problem. Okay. First of all, what do we do for this case? Different gene content. So this is important. It's important to distinguish these three cases. This is the easy case, even though it's hard, because it's neat. This is, we don't know. This is harder because the genomes don't have all have the same genes, and this is the one we're treating here. So it's important to establish that there is a way of approaching this problem, because we use it in the last problem. First of all, if we have two genomes, A and B, that have different gene content, we're not dealing with multi-gene families, just with zero or one occurrences of each gene in each genome. Let's say we wanted to measure the breakpoint distance. How would we measure them? I mean, 3 and 6. This breakpoint, look at 3 and 7. This doesn't exist. The 7 isn't here. So the fact that, okay, one second, I'll get the right 4, 5. Well, bad example. The point that the fact that the 7 doesn't exist in this genome, how are we going to calculate the genome? Can we say that it's disrupted 3-7 here, or it's not disrupted? What the definition of a breakpoint starts getting very vague. Doesn't apply, and it's trying to put a patch on it is somewhat arbitrary. So let's investigate the simplest way of doing it. It was we simply reduce each genome to include only the genes that they have in common. Then we can see that 5-3 is a breakpoint, because 5 and 3 are not adjacent here. If we're thinking of a circular genome, 5-1 is a breakpoint, but 1-3 is not a breakpoint. Why is that? Because 3 and 1, when you take away the 6, 3 and 1 are adjacent. 4-5 isn't a breakpoint. So we can define the breakpoint distance on the reduced genome, and we can say the induced breakpoint distance on these two genomes is just the breakpoint distance, the ordinary breakpoint distance between the reduced genome. I'm sorry, I've changed notations before. I called this D sub B, but now, in the phylogenetic context, it turns out that this distance, which now makes sense, because it makes sense in the sense that it measures, is a measure of the conserved order insofar as you can see it. Insofar as you can unequivocally see it. Three and one, as far as we can see it, 3 and 1 are together here, but they're also together here, because we don't know whether the absence of 6 here is because it was deleted from there or it was inserted here. But as far as we can see, with respect to the genes they have in common, 3 and 1, this is a circular genome, the order is, the adjacency is conserved. However, even this well-motivated extension of a breakpoint distance is not really a fair distance in the phylogenetic context, because suppose you have two very big genomes that are conserved 90% of their adjacencies. So the number of disruptive number of adjacencies that have been disrupted is just 10%. And then you have two very small genomes that have 50% of their breakpoints disrupted. Well, the 10% of the very big genomes is going to be more than, let's say, than the 50% of the very small genome. So you're going to get this unnormalized measure is going to be unfair, and so we just normalize. Well, what happens when we do that? Even when we start doing this, it's no longer a metric, and if you sit down and you can play with it, you can get some very dubious examples, which I won't say that they're pathological, but they're unhealthy. You can make up some examples that don't look quite right. So, however, intuitively, you want to do something like this. Maybe there's a better way of doing it, but this is sort of the simple-minded, most straightforward way. And then, we no longer can use the traveling salesman reduction, but we can. There's ways we can do it. We can build up this median genome, one gene at a time, and each time we insert another genome, we put it in such a place that minimizes the additional length. This is the additional length, and we can choose what gene to stick in. It turns out to be better. It's better to take the max of this min, take the gene that maximizes that minimum, because that gene is likely to be in three genomes around most the three genomes rather than in just two or one. So there's a strategy that works very well. It works fairly well, or it works. Whatever it is, it's a heuristic, so we repeat, since there's lots of ties here in this criteria, we do it in various orders, various starting points, and keep repeating it as many times as we have computer power, or computer time, and hopefully land on a minimal, the true median, or a true median, but it's my fault because let's just say I forgot my pens. Let's say we have three genomes here and the median. So, this is all I need. Say we have the median genome based on a certain number of genes partly built. Where are we going to insert the next gene, and which gene we're going to insert next? Well, if we took a gene that's only in one of these three genomes, we could always insert it in a great spot right next to where it is in that genome. But that would be a bad strategy because Okay, thank you. That would be a bad strategy because you're screwing up things for later insertion. So what you're going to do is calculate for every gene the best position it can go in, but then take the ones that basically are in. These are two almost equivalent ways of doing the same thing. Basically, take the one that in three, the ones that are in all three, or that are the worst. See, I'm doing it the insertion of one median at a time. But if you're doing it on the whole tree, which I haven't mentioned yet, I haven't mentioned how to do extend this to the whole tree. You're going to want to do something like this. If you're doing it just on one median, you're going to do this to put all the because this you're going to be sure that here you're going to put all the genes that are in the same order in all the three genomes, you know, first in to start this, and then the ones that the point is that there's various approach, but the general thing is you start with the most responsible strategy rather than the easiest one, sort of thing. And this max min is sort of a responsible strategy.
Isn't there going to be a correlation of branch lengths because of, you don't believe branch lengths have meaning or because of computational expediency?
Thank you, pardon?
Is the lack of incorporation of branch lengths into the algorithm because you have a prior belief that the branch lengths have no meaning or because it's simply for computational expediency?
The branch? No, the branch lengths. No, the branch length. You're minimizing the sum of the branch lengths. Okay. That's what you're trying to do. Whether it's the breakpoint distance or, okay. So.
But in terms of time, it's not clear that you want to minimize that thing because if you believe that one of those branches is long in terms of time, there's going to be more change on that branch than another.
Well, if you had, well, you know, if you're doing parsimony, you also, you know, don't know at the beginning which branch length is longer. You're still going to pick. If you just have three species, you're still going to pick the species, the hypothetical whatever taxon, which is the sum of the three distances minimal. That's parsimony. This is just a strict parsimony criterion, the way it's formulated. Now I should get to finish off with this hour. I should get to what is the role of this median problem in the, don't forget we're given a fixed phylogeny, which is not necessarily just three. It can be 10 or 50 species. Why am I concentrating on the median problem? Well, what we do to optimize a fixed phylogeny is I'm illustrating with a binary tree. It doesn't have to be a binary tree. Unrooted, I guess it has to be unrooted. At each internal node, we just construct the median problem around that internal node, and sort of we're decomposing the tree into a bunch of median problems, and then with some suitably naive or suitably sophisticated initialization of the genomes at the interior nodes, we just recalculate this median. We recalculate this median using this updated version value and continue like that. So we just redo each recalculate each interior node in some sort of cyclic fashion or random fashion or whatever, each time only, you know, under suitable constraints that we don't cycle. And we do that until convergence. And once again, we're going to get convergence to a local optimum. And don't forget that each of these media is going to involve several many tries to try to find the lowest local optimum, and then and so is the whole tree, so that there's a sort of a heuristic within a heuristic. So basically you can, this is the, this is how this, we optimize a fixed phylogeny where the genomes have either zero or one. Well, this is a general strategy for it doesn't have nothing to do with gene order. This strategy is a perfectly general strategy for optimizing a fixed phylogeny, but for the gene order problem, we have functioning software that works where every genome has either zero or one copy of every gene. Okay, so this is what we have to work with for our general problem, which involves multi-gene families. So I guess we should take a break and.
Can I just ask a question? Is this so there? Two types of problems. One is the question of the multiple optimum problem, whatever. That aside, is it also true that individually minimizing the trifurcation distances will, in principle, is that guaranteed to give you the lowest total transcript?
No, you have to. No, you can trade off. You know, have make the distance over here worse and get a much better improvement over there. That's possible. You just assume that by trying out different regimes of traversing the tree, you're going to eventually stumble on a good solution. Because, but this, you do, what you do have is that every step at every step of this, you either stay the same or you improve the overall, you decrease the overall distance on the tree. I mean, but that doesn't guarantee that. It does guarantee that in a solution, that this point will be this one will be a median. This will be you can't improve this anymore. Locally, it's true. Yeah. So, should we take a break? Okay, just out of interest, since we have maybe the luxury of time, I just want to show you some examples where we've actually used this computation for some phylogeny problems, where the number of genes is not the same in every genome, but we could only do, we couldn't handle gene families. So, we're, you know, since gene families can be found all over the place, there's not a lot of genomes that don't have gene families. We took these very small genomes, which were the mitochondria of eukaryotes, and even they have some gene duplicates, tRNAs that are duplicated and so on, and then either we had to either these tRNAs, which was pretty well recognizable from the context, or we had to throw out the genes, or sometimes we threw out the entire genome because we didn't know how to handle it. But of what was left, and so it's just to show you that the biggest mitochondrial genome has 97 genes. No one, this was a few years ago, but no one has found a bigger mitochondrial genome. And the smaller ones, I haven't even put some of them that had 20 genes or 16 genes or something like that. But of the ones that we used, you can see that they range from size of 39 or 21 here up to 97. Eventually, we threw away this one as too noisy. So when we did this, we could optimize a given phylogeny. Well, how do we know which phylogeny to optimize? Well, we calculated the induced breakpoint distance, the normalized induced breakpoint distance, and just threw them into a distance matrix program, the neighbor joining, and we got out this tree. Now, these early branching things that are mostly Jacobids, protists, which are with the big genomes, tended to group together despite the fact that distances are normalized, so they really had a affinity. These stromatopiles, which are a known group, group together, the alveolates group together. The alveolates include such well-known species as Tetrahymena. The stromatopiles include Phytophthora, which is known, which is a well-known bug. Then the red algae grouped together. But the green plants, which are green here, didn't group together. And it turns out that one of these, number 14, is a very small one with hardly any data in it. And number 16 turns out to have a highly scrambled genome, and we just arbitrarily kicked it out to see what happened. And it turned out that here, the red algae grouped together. So we just redid the thing minus these two species. Here, the green algae still grouped together, these two. The red algae grouped together, but they didn't group together. And this, there's no reason. This is a completely foreign intruder that shouldn't be in there. No, it's the in every pair of genes, in every pair of genomes, we throw away the genes that aren't in both of them, and then we normalize by the size of the common gene stock.
Pairwise distance relates only to genes that are in both, and then only related to the arrangement.
No, just the arrangement is the distance is calculated by the arrangement. Yeah. Not by, yeah, and it's they're normalized by. So basically, the only thing that is counting and making this tree is the common order as
for every pair.
For every pair.
You don't
no, this is just a based on an ordinary distance matrix, but the distance matrix was calculated by these normalized induced breakpoint measures.
Question, you threw out 16, and the rationale was two things. One is it's in the wrong place, and two, it's a very scrambled genome. Are there any other ones that are significantly more scrambled than the other ones, but you're not throwing out?
We threw out a bunch. Like, there's this one big one that Malawimonas, where is it? Here, this. Now, this one, this Malawi pneumonis, there was some question in the early days whether this, early days, 5 years ago or so, that whether this was a Jacobid or related to the Jacobids, and some of the protein studies. See, there's also protein grouping studies that have been done on these. But it turned out when we calculated the gene order distance, they were all saturated with noise. So rather than throwing in the noise and some sort of futile hope that something would be picked up, we just threw it out. By the way, some of these bugs, although most of them were known in the protist literature. Some of them are fairly recent, like this Malawi pneumonis was found in a some mud in Malawi. Some of this work, many of these mitochondria were sequenced by our own group, not me personally, but like the Reclinomonas, it was quite a surprise when that turned out to have 97 genes. So, and it threw a bit of a monkey wrench into current theories of which eukaryotes were the oldest and so on. I mean, there used to be a theory that the A mitochondrial genomes, like Giardia and Microsporidia and Japanis, and I forget the other group, were the earliest, but now it seems that Microsporidia are just like fungi. They've lost their mitochondria, so, and Giardia probably has also lost its. The earliest known, the Reclinomonas seems to be the most ancestral in terms of at least the retained mitochondrial genes. The ones that it retains are the genes that are in Reclinomonas includes all the genes that are included in any of the other mitochondria. So it really looks like an ancestral form. I mean, there's no genes down here that are not in Reclinomonas, although Reclinomonas with its 97 has a few that aren't included anywhere else. So, well, this was a morphological or also structural criteria for grouping them. Well, these ones mostly the mitochondria, there's not enough retained genes. So all these, it's true that this, except for maybe the Malawinomonas, these tend to be branching somewhere that we can't tell, no, even from the protein structure. So this discoidal cristae seems to be particular. These include all the higher organisms, basically the plants, the animals, the fungi, and going back to the algae. And notice that there's this cryptophyte, which is a protist, included in that list. And as a result of that, we decided to try. Remember, we're not calculating the tree here. We're optimizing a given tree. So the first neighbor joining thing. We left it out. We left out these two. So we started with this one. Then we arbitrarily move the red algae and the green algae together because that's where they belong, by ample phylogenetic studies with proteins. And then we decided to take this flattened cristae Rhodomonas one and also stick it with this group in the hopes that, in the off chance that might be a valid grouping. And it is no longer. This we wouldn't think do this anymore. So the fact that it has a flattened cristae is not particularly relevant. Or these things are not easy to see under the microscope either. So they're somewhat arbitrary. So then we basically optimized all these trees, and this tree. It turned out that we ran the experiments both in. I didn't bring the runs. We ran the experiments both in terms of the medians. We tried different approaches, how many times we ran them and how many times we ran the whole tree. And we kept getting improvements. So this one turned out to be slightly less, but slightly better than the others, but hardly as you'd hardly notice. This one, so the point is that the real thing to notice from this is that the neighbor joining, in other words, the distance matrix, basically conserved a great deal of the phylogenetic signal, because these things, this tree, makes a lot of sense. And it's only based on the order of the genes, remember, in the genomes. There's no sequence comparison, there's nothing, there's just the order. So just the distance matrix breaks this thing, and you know, they're very different bugs, even though they might be in the same families. They don't look at all the same, and they have found in different places and so on, but there's enough conserved signal in the gene orders to so that most of this tree makes a great deal of sense. Most of the gene trees fit fairly well with this. Okay, there was, you know, there's genes where, you know, there's a ribosomal RNA genes in here, and if you use that, you get pretty much the same. But the gene trees are, a lot of them are in conflict with each other and so on. But this is as good as the gene trees, as any of the particular gene trees. I don't really believe that, okay? I don't believe that this I think in certain contexts where maybe the molecular clock for a lot of the genes is very fast, then maybe the molecular clock, there's no molecular clock really for this rearrangement process, but that might be slow. I think that may happen sometimes, okay? I think this is probably worse. This is probably worse. Okay. In certain, we know, you know, if you look in the primates, there's a lot of, I didn't mention this, but special kinds of translocations, which are basically chromosome fusions and fissions, are rampant. But you don't get that in a lot of other areas. You know, the fungal genomes, the fungal mitochondria show hardly any inversion in certain of them. You know, whereas these will show a lot of inversion. So we don't, there's no, you have to be careful about what the evolutionary demand that you're going to define your clock in. You know, it's, you know, it's a whole covariant thing.
So I'm just curious, so why then do you want to pursue this particular avenue?
Which? Because it, you know, we're reconstructing ancestral genomes and the gene orders. We like to do that, you know, and it's meaning.
What kind of a beast is Jacobit?
Beg your pardon?
What kind of a beast is a Jacobit?
A Jacobit is some kind of amoeba, you know, like it looks like a little bowl with a flagella or a cilia sticking out of it, and sort of a feeding groove, you know, and it, you know, if you look. It looks completely, these protists all look very, very weird. The article, the cover of Science, where this article, the Reclamomonas article was published, has sort of a tree with all the protists, and they all look very, very different. I mean, they, you know, apparently they have a lot in common, but they're very weird looking things. And they have a surprisingly large amount of structure.
Branch lengths are not displayed here, that this doesn't refer, that we shouldn't take the branch lengths as indicative of anything.
No, it was a neighbor joining. Why isn't the branch length there? Let me move on to my next example, which answers some of these questions a bit better. This was done on the basis of chloroplasts, okay? Chloroplast genomes. And and these trees were taken from a paper of Lemieux and Termel, who used maybe 50 protein sequences and all together to make their tree. And they found out that this one, and they were mostly interested in this thing that they just sequenced, this mesostigma, which seemed to be very early branching streptophyte, which includes the lime plants, or a very early branching chlorophyte, which are the true algae, or a common branching just before the divergence of the chlorophytes and streptophytes. And these are the three trees that had any support at all in their data, and this one was clearly the best one. On the basis of the gene order, again, we had to throw away half of the inverted repeats and other, we had a whole bunch of problems because of the gene family, multi-gene family problem, but which we resolved in various ad hoc ways. We found that these were the only trees that had any support. And we didn't quite get this one. We got this one, where the mesostigma turned out to be an early branching relative of the land plants. But between this one and this one, there's very little. In other words, the signal from the phylogenetic signal from the gene order was highly conserved in these, in my judgment, in these chloroplasts. Again, I thought I was going to say something about the length of the branches, but I just realized that these were from the protein tree a lot. So I don't really, but there is, I didn't do this on purpose, but there is a problem with the lengths of the branches with this method, is that the median tends to give you, whenever it can, something on a corner. So there's non-uniqueness of the median, and often it's going to go for a corner, and you get it very embarrassing when the tree comes out, and very embarrassing when the tree comes out, and all the ancestral nodes are modern-day nodes, except one or two. You know, you say, why am I bothering this? Why don't I do a minimal spanning tree on these things? But it's not completely true. There are many instances where you're not at a corner, and there's ways of dealing with the problem so that the median is defined to be something which is not biased towards a corner, and so on. I just.
Where the normal thing for being able to predict protein structure was that you take a protein structure, you know, you hide it from yourself, you work on your method, and you see, can I predict the structure when I know the answer? And you explore that. And people got pretty good at that. And then there was this contest of actually trying to predict structures with where you didn't know what the answer was, that the answer was revealed, you know, after all the predictions were in. And the change in ability to predict went way, way down, you know, when you went from, you know, it was just a really sobering. So, so it wasn't that people were consciously trying to cheat, it's just that you try different things and you say, this is working, it's giving you the right answer. So I'm wondering, especially when there are a lot of ad hoc things that you're doing, it seems very easy to have knowledge of the final result sneak in somehow into your method.
Well, you know, the only thing that snuck in was that we tried some trees that we threw data out because it didn't fit, and we were very explicit about it. But remember, the trees themselves are constructed by neighbor joining, which had nothing to do.
I'm saying in terms of the implementation of the breakpoint analysis, you mentioned that there are some ad hoc fixes that you have to make.
Oh yeah, well that, we have no ways of knowing what the original genomes are anyway, but. Let me just show you another thing we did with the chloroplasts. We threw in some of these secondary endosymbiotic events, like Euglena, which is known to get its chloroplast by eating basically a green algae. And it's interesting to see that Euglena, the ancestor of Euglena itself, wasn't a green algae, but some other protist. It ate a green algae. And its chloroplast groups in terms of green orders with the green plants. Odontella was some sort of protist that ate a red algae. And you can see, you know, it has the extra membrane in the mitochondria from where it, you know, left over from the poor red algae that it ate, plus the chloroplast membrane. And so Odontella groups with the red algae, and the same story with Doxoplasma. So that was plasma. So that was interesting. But I'm running out of time. So I'm going to. I've only talked about one aspect of this. What are we going to do with multi-gene families? This is the this is the remaining couple of problems. Say we have two genomes, okay? Basically, and I'm sure you're going to ask me to justify it, so I won't say make too much of it now. We basically take one example, one gene from each gene family, and throw the rest away. So we're going to reduce our genomes once again by taking one gene from each. So we have A here and A here. We're just going to take this one A. We have C, C, and C. We're just going to take this one C. And we're going to do that for every gene family in this genome and every gene family in this genome. And how are we going to pick them? We're going to pick them so that we'll pick them simultaneously in such a way as to minimize the distance. So we're not just taking any old A here and here. We're taking this A in conjunction with this A in conjunction with this B in conjunction with this B, and we're taking them all simultaneously in such a way as we get the minimum possible distance. And with a lot of hand waving, we can make we can try to make the argument that the reduced genomes thus constructed will be less scrambled in terms of, well, they will be less scrambled in, with respect to each other. They will be by definition. And in addition, that they will better reflect, in some sense, the ancestral genome of the two. And, okay. So this can be done with breakpoint distance, with inversion distance, with any distance. And it turns out to be a hard problem that's been shown. But it's actually not that hard in practice. Okay, there's branch and bound algorithms which run quite quickly and for reasonable size methods. Now, what's the justification for that? I'll just say a couple of words. If you make a model of genome rearrangement which involves duplication, what happens often is you get a tandem repeat, and then one of these pairs will be thrown out by inversions or transpositions or translocations or whatever somewhere else in the genome. Or you might get a repeat for some reason that immediately appears somewhere else in the genome. And the logic is that there will be one copy of each gene family which is more in context, in the original context, than any others. For example, this 3 is between 2 and 4 where it started, whereas this 3, whether because of this move or this move, will be farther, will be in a foreign context. The same thing when the 9s duplicate. Well, here's a 9 that's between 8 and 10, and this 9 is somewhere else. So in some essence, there will be one copy of the, you know, of course, if one becomes a pseudogene, this all falls apart, or tends to fall, we tend to lose signal. But hopefully there's enough signal left in the context so that the ones that we, by throwing away this one instead of this one, the exemplar distance, the distance between the two reduced genomes, will be less. And that'll recover the true positions, or closer to the true positions. So, you know, I can't say more about that because... Well, there's some tandem duplication. It's well known that there's a lot of tandem duplication. And some of these tandem duplications are later disrupted. That's a common procedure. And there's also other...
And do these duplicate
it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter which one is moved of the two.
What is the movement usually? Well,
if they're moved. Yeah, you're right. You're right. You could move if it moved 3, 4, 5, 6 together. You couldn't distinguish which was better. But in general, there'll be a tendency for some advantage, hopefully for one gene to be recognizable this way. I mean, it may not work.
What's the force that wants to separate it?
Well, say we had a small inversion that moved this away, and then a large inversion. This one would still look to be the rearrangement distance would still tend to pick this one out. Okay, you could have some sort of a transposition of this by itself elsewhere. Okay, who knows? I haven't even done simulations on this, so I can't say more. I don't want to defend this biologically too much because, I don't feel that strongly. But let me just say a bit now about the whole problem of species tree and genes tree reconstruction. So if this is, say we take a gene and we make a gene tree based on a nucleotide sequence, okay? Then we take another gene, we get another gene tree, and we all know that this happens all the time in biology, and if you take another gene, you'll get a different gene tree. So every gene you take, of course, with only 5 species, you're going to get the same one showing up once in a while, but we know that you get different genes with different trees with different genes, and they tend to resemble each other, but they're not exactly. The question is, let's forget about this part. Instead of saying that, well, we don't have enough data, or one method is wrong, or whatever, let's say that these gene trees are all right, and that just what's happened is that there's been a process of duplication and loss. I just want to show you. Say you had 5 genomes, and each of them had 2 copies of a gene, like the example we were talking about earlier. One extreme gene tree could look like this. All of one gene from each genome grouped together in this pattern, and the other gene grouped together in this pattern, and these two patterns were the same. It's clear in the history of this gene what happened. It was a duplication before all the species diverged. There was one duplication, and afterwards, each duplicate gene evolved by itself independently in normal clock-like fashion or whatever you want, and you got this thing. You could also conceivably get this tree where, A1, the 2 copies in A group together, 2 copies of B group together, and this is what happens if, you had normal speciation and then suddenly a comet hit and every gene had to produce twice as much of something, every organism suddenly had to produce twice as much of something to stay alive, and so you got all these duplications. This is ridiculous, but you got all these duplications at the same time. So here there would be 5 duplications, and here there would be just 1. And in between these, you get every possible permutational combination of possible results from this type of data. And what's worse, you also get usually gene loss. So some of the genes get lost. Some of the copies get lost. Now, what the reconciliation algorithms do, they take if this is the real species tree and this is the gene tree, they try to explain this result in terms of duplication and loss. And the explanation would be there'd be a duplication here. One copy was lost in this branch. Sorry. One copy was lost in this lineage, and the other copy was lost in this lineage, so with the result that the C and E group together, and the D, which has the ancestral or the odd man out copy, so this is a reconciliation of this gene tree against this species tree. Now, this is a very non-parsimonious explanation to explain this difference. I'd rather, you'd probably want to attribute to the fact that you're using the wrong program, or you didn't have, the sequences weren't long enough or something. But in general, when you have several copies, when it's clear that you have multi-gene families, you have to make this type of argument. There's an enormous literature, there's a big literature on this problem, and there's lots of algorithms to do this automatically, and both some very good computer scientists in here, Hallett and Legendren, Uhlenstein et al, Ma, and biologists Page, Goodman, they've all produced algorithms to do... I just wanted to show basically what these methods do is project this is the species tree, the given species tree. This has two copies, this has three copies, this has one copy, this has two copies of the gene. You make the gene tree. And then there are rules for projecting the nodes of the gene tree onto the nodes of the species tree, and you can imagine what they would be, the type of things. You can see that there these lines coming into one node don't cross and all that. It's not very complicated to work out. And basically what this tells you, can I let go here? What this basically tells you, I'm changing examples to a simpler example, is that for example, if this is a genome with gene B in it, small b, and here there's three copies of gene B spread out along the genome in those positions, and here's two copies. It'll tell you how many copies of that gene B were in that ancestor, and how many copies were in that ancestor. I put two in each, but it could have been, you know, three here and two here, or even two here and three here. And it tells you which ones descended from which ones, okay? So that this one here just had one descendant, one normal descendant in each genome, on each of these two genomes, but this one had two descendants. In other words, there was a duplication event here. This is what the reconciliation algorithm will tell you. And here's another gene. So basically it tells you the gene content of the ancestors, but it doesn't tell you their order. So how are we going to get the order? I just want to, this is just a little helper slide. Say we have a genome with all these copies of gene A, its ancestor with just three copies, and its ancestor with just one copy. What we're going to be doing is for each ancestor gene that has descendants, pick one which is its exemplar. So this is sort of like the one-way exemplar problem. You don't pick in both genomes, you just pick in. And here, of these three descendants of the original A, we're going to pick an exemplar for each one. Even though this was not the exemplar, it's of importance for us to, in establishing the gene orders, to pick its exemplar, because it's going to have exemplars as descendants as well. So we're going to have, for each gene that has descendants we're going to pick an exemplar amongst its descendants. And notice that these are, I've all labeled these all A, but somehow they're distinguished, these three exemplars, they're distinguished by the identity of their immediate ancestors. So I won't put in any fancy labeling in this thing, but the idea is we're not just taking one exemplar all the way down the tree. Every time we have a descendant, we're going to take an exemplar. Now we're in a position to reformulate our original problem, since we know how to do the median problem, and hence the phylogeny optimization problem, the optimizing a given phylogeny problem, with respect to genomes that have either zero or one copy of all genes. We know how to pick exemplars, and we know how to reconcile gene trees and species trees. So now we can rephrase our original problem. We want to estimate the ancestral genomes. First of all, we find the gene content at the ancestral nodes. That is done for us by the reconciliation algorithms. We find a gene order at each ancestral node, and amongst a gene order of these genes, okay? And an exemplar for each family, in the sense that I just showed you. So for every gene, if it has descendants, there'll be an exemplar amongst those descendants. So an exemplar with respect to the parent node, such that the sum of the exemplar distances is minimized. We don't know how to calculate the genomic distances on these branches for multi-gene families, except by taking the exemplars. So we calculate the sum of the exemplars. We now have, so this problem is now well posed, okay? And, you know, I'm flogging this proceedings that Paul is carrying around. There's a couple, this whole thing has been appeared in a couple of proceedings. Let me give you just a quick indication of how you would actually implement this thing in a heuristic way. Say we started with, this is part of the tree, A, B, there'd be a bunch, this is just at one corner of the tree, A, B is our given genomes, X is their common ancestor, C is its ancestor, which would have other descendants as well. The first step, we choose the exemplars, okay? Then, what the exemplar does, it gives us a unique ancestor for, unique descendants for every gene in C that has descendants in X, and for every gene in X that has descendants, it gives you a unique descendant exemplar gene. And you can trace which genes are in common in A, B, and C through these choice of exemplars. Then you're in a situation where you can use your median routine, because you have in these exemplars at most one copy of each gene in the special sense that I mentioned. So we have where we can use this median routine that works with zero or one member of each gene family. That gives us an improved X, the gene order of X, and we continue like that. We choose exemplars. We move up the tree to the next ancestor, W. We use the improved X here. We choose exemplars here, here, and here. We apply the median routine. We've improved C, and so on. And we hope that we can iterate up and down the tree. Of course, we haven't implemented this, but there are a couple of patches that you have to be careful to make sure that you only improve at each step, that you don't get a worse tree. But basically, that is a heuristic approach to solving this problem. Maybe there's a better approach. Would be a heuristic as well, but at least we have these technologies of reconciliation, median routine, and exemplar distances, which fit together in this definition of the problem in this very sort of dovetailed way that makes sense out of it. or something.